This is just an audio recording, and it can be edited, so if you accidentally say your first and last name and like an indictment number and then you don't want that to be on the recording, we can cut it out, but try not to say your first and last name and like an indictment number if you prefer to not have that. I think it will be posted, like the archives from last year are posted online somewhere. But if you slip up, just say something afterwards and we'll be sure that. Isn't your voice? So I guess we'll get started. I think some people will probably trickle in between the rain and the trek from Judson and the security procedures downstairs. My name's Danielle, and I'm really excited to be moderating this today, which is a discussion about prisons and resistance. So the context, we'll talk a bit about the political and racialized context of prisons in this country. We'll talk about resistance behind bars as well as from the other side. We'll talk about political prisoners. And each of our panelists is someone I'm very excited to have here with us today. And so they'll share probably for 7 to 10 minutes or so about their perspective. Come on. And then we'll open it up for discussion. So I may ask a couple questions first, but mostly we'll just have room to talk about it, and hopefully we'll have a balance between some of the bigger ideas and also some of the opportunities to contribute to different kinds of resistance in different ways. So Vivian is starting it off for us, and Vivian is a professor at UMass and has done a lot of work about looking at prison as a war strategy, looking at methods of resistance, looking really closely at music and the way music connects to traditions and practices of resistance over time. And she's going to set up some of the context for us to understand the prison industrial complex in this country. So,
cool. Well, thanks for all coming out in this crazy weather and going through security to get up to this room so we can talk about prisons. I always say that if I talk about prisons, it's impossible not to talk about white supremacy, because white supremacy created the criminal justice system that we have today. And I also want to clarify that when I talk about criminal justice, that I am talking about a criminal type of justice system. So it's not necessarily justice, it's just criminal justice. Does that make sense? So always keep that in mind, because we're taught through the language and institutions to criminalize each other or communities. And I think that on many levels, the titles that they give their own institutions are very telling. So it's the criminal justice system. And at the root of this criminal justice system is this concept of segregation, which we often associate with like Jim Crow laws and apartheid. And we know that that's sort of the height and most visible forms of white supremacy, right? So at the root of the concept of criminal justice is the idea that segregation is necessary and natural. And also the idea that segregation provides safety, when really segregation is something that breaks and ruptures and murders. And so also to keep that in mind, that this concept of criminal justice is based on segregation. And I also, what I want to do for this presentation is talk about where this concept of segregation came from. And I want to do it from a historical perspective, because I think as somebody who studies prisons and does work inside prisons, sometimes you get wrapped up in the immediate institution of imprisonment, and then you lose sight of the larger picture. So for the past year, I've been trying to figure out this larger picture. And having gone to school for criminology and criminal justice, and sitting through some of the most fascist university classrooms you can sit through, and receiving a PhD in fear, which is a PhD in criminal justice, I at some point had to step back, which is why I started doing research with music and looking at lyrics that traced the cross-Atlantic slave route, so lyrics from Nigeria, the Caribbean, and the United States, and looking at what people in the lyrics are saying about justice and white supremacy. At the same time, criminology and criminal justice, much like the institution of prison, is segregated from all the other disciplines that surround it. And because they create these disciplines that are supposed to exist in isolation from each other, they are able to conquer knowledge. And so what I started to do was to desegregate knowledge by bringing in archaeology, history, different types of science, literature, ethnomusicology. And right now, you're going to hear about this because it's the thing that I'm most interested in for the past year, is rewriting a timeline which would help us see the larger picture of history. And so, and this timeline is inspired by my research on music, because my dissertation committee asked me to write a chapter on Black history. And quickly through the lyrics, I began to understand that Black history has become a dumping ground for all of the bad things that white people have done. So slavery, apartheid, colonialism, Jim Crow, all of these things being acts committed by Europeans and colonists who are from Europe, yet we classify them as Black history. And that's problematic because it's degrading, not just because it's degrading, but also because they've erased Black history, because they've replaced Black history with this concept of white supremacist Black history. So I had to reject this notion of Black history and to begin to rebuild what I think Black history is, and that would include studying and documenting events and acts that were done by Black people, that being Black history. So it took me all the way back to 2650 BC, which is the first documented voyages from Africa to the United States. A Black Egyptian pharaoh named Sneferu built 63 ships that measured 100 to 179 feet each, and he sailed across the Atlantic, and archaeological evidence does support this fact. A European scholar named Bailey in 1973 decided to test this theory to make sure that it wasn't true. His hypothesis was that this is not possible, so he actually rebuilt the ships in 1973 and expected them to sink, and they actually sailed all the way across the Atlantic. So 2650 BC. For hundreds of years, African scholars have been talking about these voyages, and that being Black history, and the fact that the world has never existed in isolation. Because the European version of history is that these continents exist in isolation from each other, and then Europeans traveled in the 1400s and desegregated the world, which is the opposite of a world existing together. Let's not romanticize it. Some good, some bad, but most of the interactions did not result in genocide, right? So the world existing back and forth, interacting, and becoming segregated through European colonialism. So 2650 BC, 800 BC, there are African terracotta stoneheads in Mexico and Central America. And if you start to interrogate what they mean by Mexico, that also includes the United States, because that boundary between Mexico and the US is very new. 300 BC, you have a redrawn revision of a map, and it is a map of the world. It was discovered by a man named Piriri. He was a Turkish explorer. And on this map, which is a redrawn revision of the world, you have the Mid-Atlantic Islands, Cape Verde, Madeira Islands, the Azores. In perfect longitude, you have the Canary Islands, only off by 1 degree. You have the Andes, the Erato River in Colombia, the Amazon River. And even more remarkable is the near accuracy of the longitudinal and latitudinal coordinates between Africa and the Americas. And so when you go into just a very basic, and this is just scratching the level of archaeology, into a very basic research of what history looks like, it's not hard to find these documented, even European documented, existence of people traveling. 1250 AD, you have the Mandingo traders, because often white supremacy will teach us that Egypt is not a part of Africa, which it is, and I attest to that because I am from Egypt and I'm African. But there's also sub-Saharan Africa, the Mandingo travelers from what is now called Mali, traveled in 1250 BC, and again in 1250 AD, and then again in 1311 AD, and these ships that traveled actually stayed. So about 2,000 ships traveled across the Atlantic about 100 years before Columbus. And so when Columbus arrived in what is now called the United States, it was actually a very multicultural society. And there was as many people here as there are on the African continent today. And so the images that we are given of these continents on this side of the Atlantic are also very segregated, monolithic, and so-called uncivilized. So there was actually hundreds of thousands of Black people already existing and living here in the United States. In 1991, the U.S. government gave back some of the land they took from the Black folks that were here already. So all of that being said, in 1480, the first European colonists arrived in Brazil, and his name was Cabral. It was not Columbus who came first from Europe. It was a man named Cabral. And he arrived here in 1480. In 1482, you have the first slave dungeons being built in West Africa. And then 10 years later, in 1492, you have Columbus arriving on the shores of the Americas. And this is significant because these parts of history that we are not often shown illustrate many things. So why would they say that Columbus was the first one here? Because the Portuguese lost the war and they did not get to write history and make their Portuguese explorer the first guy as a recorded European colonist that arrived here, right? And so when you begin to look at these historical lessons, you can see the parts that have been glamorized and publicized and the parts that have been hidden. And through deciphering that, you can see at the root of it, not just white supremacy, but war. And so the First World War began, in my opinion, when these ships, from the European ships, traveled across the ocean with slaves inside them. And that war has continued for 400 years, up until the first defined European World War in 1914. And when Europeans began to die, they defined that as a war. So the first prisons, according to European history, were built in the 1700s. This is simply not true. When I was living in West Africa, I saw the slave dungeons. I saw that the slave dungeons actually became prisons physically as buildings when the British arrived and colonized Ghana. And so the first prisons were not built in the 1700s, they were built in the 1400s. In terms of what that looks like in the United States, those prisons existed on plantations, right? Those prisons existed on slave ships. So the architecture of punishment is something that has been strategized, created by scientists, physicians, archaeologists, and so on and so forth, right? And so what you have to understand is that when we talk about the prison today, it comes out of this history of 500 years of segregation and violence, and at the root of all that is a racialized violence that we have to understand. And so in order for us to talk about prisons, we must talk about white supremacy, and we must understand white supremacy as a form of war. And in order to dismantle what we now call the prison industrial complex, we must dismantle white supremacy. And we must begin to learn to see the world as it exists, with all of its violence, but also all of its beauty, and to desegregate our understandings of this world. And I think one of the biggest issues that we face today is the segregated experiences people have in communities and in societies. So the Black community's experience with the prison is radically different from the white community, the immigrant community, right? The middle class, the lower class, the gendered, the age. So all of these things exist in isolation, and I think that at the root of that is our view of the world. Because on some level, if we believe that the continents were segregated prior to European travels, then we also believe that segregation is something that is natural and that we have to fight against to desegregate, as opposed to understanding that segregation is unnatural and we have to fight against that as an unnatural thing that separates us from each other. And so at the root of this violence is this notion of segregation, which rears its head through these laws that are clearly segregationist. But we have to see it beyond these laws and begin to understand the foundations of that. And until we dismantle those foundations, we will always come up against specific laws or institutions that legalize segregation. That's it.
And we're going to let, for those of you who have come in, we're going to invite all three of the panelists to speak 7 to 10 minutes or so on the perspective that they're contributing to this conversation, and then we'll be opening it up for dialogue and discussion. So Vicky Law is here to talk to us about, primarily about women's experience of prison and of the institution of prisons, and has done a lot of work on resistance behind bars. So there will be room in this conversation for us to talk about how we resist from the outside, how people have resisted historically. But I think very frequently we forget about the very real and daily resistance that occurs within prisons and jails all over this country all the time. And so I'm really excited to have Vicky here to bring that perspective to our dialogue.
So Vivian talked a lot about racial segregation, or this idea that like the continents were racially segregated, and how this impacts like what we think of like prison and incarceration. Sure. What I wanted to talk about is how incarceration and gender also intersect. Before the 1700s, 1800s, women were mostly kept in their homes, or they were sort of punished outside of what we call the criminal justice system. But as women became more independent from their households, they started going out to work, they started gaining more rights, prisons became a way to monitor and punish their behaviors. So women were arrested and incarcerated for behaviors like being drunk, having premarital sex, having sex outside of marriage, getting an STD, keeping bad company, which meant that if a relative didn't like your friends or didn't like the fact that you would go out, they could call the police on you and the police would come and arrest you. And you have to keep in mind that men were not arrested for these same behaviors. This was a very specific form of gender control in which they wanted to keep, in which women were kept from asserting their independence in ways that were threatening to the status quo. And then, in addition, under the guise of rehabilitating or reforming them, women received longer sentences than their male counterparts. So if there was a man and a woman arrested for larceny, the woman would receive a longer sentence because she needed to be rehabilitated or reformed. She was considered a fallen woman, and she needed additional rehabilitation, which could mean being locked up in a cell in a predominantly male prison. When they did have female reformatories in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the idea was to reform women to make them these virtuous women on the under the model of the middle class white housewife. So women were taught these domestic skills that they may or may not have been able to use unless they worked as domestic servants later on, because they just didn't have the economic opportunity to sit at home and keep house. And when they deviated from these norms, they would be rehabilitated, sometimes by being tied up and having their heads continually thrust into a bucket of water, and this was considered treatment for things like that. So it wasn't this nice, I don't know, like reform school type of thing where like women were taught skills. They were actually punished, and sometimes they were very brutally punished for this. So with the rise of the reformatory, women were sentenced to what was called indeterminate sentencing, which meant that you didn't have a specific out date. And the first indeterminate sentencing law was in 1869, and it was passed in Michigan on the grounds that women convicted of prostitution needed extensive retraining before they could be reformed. That same year, the Michigan State Legislature rejected a proposal for indeterminate sentencing for men. So this was something that they only wanted to do with women because they felt that women really needed this retraining to conform to gender norms. Fast forward a few decades later, and in 1913, Pennsylvania passed the Muncie Act, stating that women convicted of an offense that would be punishable by more than 1 year would receive an indeterminate sentence. So if a woman did something and the courts ruled that she could spend a year and a half in prison, it automatically turned into an indeterminate sentence. Men, however, this rule did not apply to men at all. And as late as 1966, Pennsylvania courts have upheld that the sentencing policy is not unconstitutional. In 1966, the Superior Court of Pennsylvania stated that women's inherent physical and psychological differences justified this treatment. And so it was reasonable for women to receive longer sentences, especially because they received more effective rehabilitation while incarcerated. Keep in mind that until the turn of the last century, women were often housed in male prisons. The prison was not specifically built for women. It wasn't built with women in mind, so they were housed in attics, cellars, sometimes in adjacent cells. They were given even less access to what passed for rehabilitation or programming in prison. They were more subject to sexual abuse. In one case in Indiana, the guards were running a prostitution service using female prisoners and selling them to male prisoners. So there were all sorts of, you know, there were all sorts of reasons why this was not rehabilitation. So if you come to the present day, you realize that there are huge issues with incarceration. There are almost 3 million people behind bars, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics just released a report that said that 1 in 31 Americans are under some form of correctional supervision at this time. So either parole, probation, jail, prison. And the number of women has been growing exponentially, even more so than men going to prison. And they face many of the same issues as men in prison, so bad health care, lack of programming, overcrowded, brutality from the staff. But then there are also issues that impact them adversely because of their gender. For instance, with healthcare, everybody gets crappy healthcare in prison. There is not good healthcare. But with women, there's also a lack of attention to specifically female concerns. So many prisons do not have OBGYN services. They don't have facilities to deal with, or resources to deal with women who come in pregnant, or women who come in with any sort of specifically female problems like cervical cancer, breast cancer, family history of having any of these cancers. There isn't preventative measures like cancer screenings for these cancers. There's not treatment, so a woman can find a lump in her breast and wait up to a decade to actually have the prison take it seriously. In addition, women in prison are more likely to be HIV positive than either men in prison or women on the outside. A study found that in 2000, women in prison were 60% more likely to have HIV than men entering prison, and women in prison are 36 times more likely than women on the outside to have HIV. And this is not because they're passing needles inside, but because women who go to prison are usually on the lowest economic strata on the outside, and they're not getting healthcare services, and they're not getting other services that might have prevented this. In addition, more than 80% of women in prison are mothers to children under the age of 18. And I say more than 80% because there isn't, as far as I know, an agency that specifically collects data as to how many women go to prison leaving children under the age of 18 behind. And it's actually in the woman's best interest, if she's got grandma or a sister or somebody else that will care for her children, not to report this because their children can be sent to foster care. And 10% of children of imprisoned mothers in foster are 10% of children with mothers in prison are in foster care versus 2% of children of incarcerated fathers. When men go to prison, or when fathers go to prison, usually there is a female caretaker that will step up, a mother, a lover, a wife. Somebody will step up and take care of this man's children, thus making sure that they don't go into foster care. When women go to prison, oftentimes they've been the single heads of household beforehand, or the partner in their life leaves. So their children are a lot more likely to end up in foster care. And this is particularly problematic because in 1997, the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed, saying that if a child spent 15 of the past 22 months in foster care, the state would automatically terminate their parental rights. And only two states made an exception for the child's parent being in prison. But the other 48 states say, after 15 months, we automatically terminate parental rights and your child can be adopted out. You will not have contact with your child. And if their foster family or adoptive family doesn't want you around, they can make sure that you can never, ever see your child again. And keep in mind that women are going to prison for all sorts of things, but mostly nonviolent, economic, and drug-related crimes. In addition, more than half of women in state prisons and jails report having experienced physical and/or sexual abuse prior to incarceration. Again, these are women who don't have a lot of opportunities, come from the lowest economic strata, and in addition, have suffered some sort of abuse in their lives. And women in prison are three times more likely than men to have been physically and/or sexually abused prior to incarceration, which leads to partially leads to the fact that women are sexually assaulted oftentimes while in prison. They're sexually abused, sexually harassed. Under the Equal Rights Act of 1964, male guards are allowed to work in female prisons, and there are only a couple of states in which the women have fought legally to keep the male guards out of their housing units, because legally they're allowed to work in the prison in whatever units, and they can work, say, in the bathroom area, and monitor women as they're on the toilet or while they're showering or undressing as part of their job. Now that I've thrown all these wonderful things out at you, I wanted to also talk about how women have organized inside to challenge these realities, so it's not just all like bad things happen and they just sit there and take it. And some of these ways have not been considered as glamorous or exciting as, like Attica or the Lucasville Uprising or, any of the prison riots that we usually read about when we read about prisoner organizing. So in 1987, at Bedford Hills, which is in Westchester County, about an hour and a half from here, the women in prison there realized that HIV and AIDS was a huge concern among the women in prison, and there was a huge stigma and ostracism of women with HIV and AIDS. Women were being forced off of housing units if they were perceived to be HIV positive. Women weren't getting tested, they weren't seeking treatment, and they were really afraid to like come out as being HIV positive because women would circulate petitions saying we don't want this person on our housing unit, she might breathe on us. There was a lot of ignorance both from fellow prisoners and from staff members who also didn't want to deal with people who were HIV positive. They were afraid they would somehow catch HIV just by serving somebody food or being in their proximity. And the women imprisoned at Bedford Hills realized that changing attitudes around that disease required them to play an active role rather than have somebody from the outside come in once a month and give a talk. So they originally started by asking the prison administration if they could go in and care for women with HIV and AIDS in the intensive care unit because the staff at the intensive care unit, both medical staff and the guards, didn't want to deal with these women. And this led to at least one woman dying by herself because nobody would deal with her or answer her calls one night. In addition, they started helping women prepare for their medical exams by working with them to define and articulate their questions about their status. They accompanied women to medical consultations to help them, to help facilitate their doctor-patient conversations. And they presented educational seminars to women, often using role-playing to break through barriers and stereotypes to generate discussion and examine the issues. In an article in 1999, one woman who was active in the AIDS counseling and education program said, "If you hear stigma now, there are five people who immediately say, 'Why did you have to say that? This is not okay anymore, and I know this is a direct result of ACE and the education process.'" In contrast, I got a letter last year from a woman in Oklahoma who has been trying to do peer education around HIV and AIDS with women there and has not gotten that same sort of has not had that same history of organizing around this issue. And she said, "The level of ignorance is shocking. Women still say stuff like, 'I don't want to wash my clothes after her. What if her panties were bloody?' People don't want to share cells or meals, so most women just keep their status a secret. And when you're keeping your status a secret, you're also not seeking medical treatment for being HIV positive because you don't want other people knowing that you're HIV positive." I talked about how most women had suffered some form of abuse and battering, and this is something that seems more prevalent among women who go to prison than men who go to prison. And women have also organized around the fact that they have been battered and have been abused in their life. In the late 1980s, women serving life sentences in Marysville, Ohio, started a group called LIFE, Looking Inward for Excellence, as a support group for women with long sentences. And over time, they realized that many of them had been sentenced to life in prison for killing their abusers. This was at a time when people weren't recognizing battering or domestic violence as an issue. It wasn't coming up in court. People didn't know they could bring it up in court. And women themselves often didn't recognize that it was abused, it was wrong. They didn't somehow bring it on themselves, that they were being battered. So the women there began organizing around domestic violence and organized a clemency campaign to free women in prison for self-defense. So they met with the then governor's assistant and his wife, and they went back and began starting a clemency campaign, asking the governor to review the sentences of every woman who had been convicted for defending herself against her abuser, and asking that he consider clemency in releasing all of them. And in addition, they spoke with other prisoners and encouraged other women to apply for clemency. And in some instances, they helped the women overcome denial. So this was not like just sitting down once, but it was like talking with them again and again to make them understand that what had happened was abuse, it was battering. To help them remember incidents of battering and recall where they might find documentation like police reports or hospital reports to back up their request for clemency. And their efforts led to 18 more women applying for clemency than would have otherwise. And in the end, 25 women were granted clemency and released from prison, which, you know, was the first mass clemency campaign around battered spouses in the U.S. Their actions also influenced women in a California domestic violence support group called Convicted Women Against Abuse to begin their own mass clemency campaign. Again, this group was originally a self-help group for women doing long sentences, and they realized that many of them were imprisoned for killing their abusers. So they attempted to do their own clemency drive, and they wrote a letter to then-Governor Pete Wilson asking him to consider clemency for every single woman incarcerated in the state of California for killing their abusers. And they also invited him to one of their weekly meetings so that he could understand how they had ended up in prison and what the effects of abuse were. Governor Wilson, who seems to be one of these law and order politicians, declined the request and said that he would consider the letter as a request for clemency only by the woman who signed it. So he was not going to go into the files of every single woman in California and look for and consider their cases. And in the end, he granted clemency only to 3 women, denied it to 7, and made no response on 24 of these women. But the other result of this group's clemency campaign was that they drew the attention of outside advocates and lawyers who helped the women draft their arguments and gather evidence for their petitions, and also formed a group called that is now called Free Battered Women that continues organizing and raising awareness about the effects of abuse and the fact that there are battered women in prison for killing their abusers. So their efforts led to like a more far-reaching or like outside group that would start doing this kind of work and raising awareness, whereas before they had been none. So, and then one last thing that I wanted to bring up, and then I will turn it over to you, is that women have also filed lawsuits to change their conditions, which might not fall under what we would think of as prison abolition, but when you realize there are so many people in prison and so many women in prison under these horrific circumstances or conditions, this is really important for sort of getting to the day-to-day, through the day-to-day. In 1977, at Bedford Hills, again, 1.5 hours here, women filed Forts versus Ward and won. And this lawsuit was to prevent male staff members from being in areas where women might be in a state of undress. So they basically won a lawsuit that said that the men, male guards had to stay out of the shower areas, out of the toilet areas. Women who were in cells with windows could actually put a piece of paper up over their cell windows for up to 15 minutes so that they could dress and undress without a male guard walking in on them. And the male guards could not be in the housing area at night, which might lead to more sexual abuse when women are sleeping or in states of undress. And they also had to announce male on the floor, you know, 5 minutes before entering so that women who were in a state of undress could throw something on and not be fully exposed. More recently in Michigan, Michigan women won a similar lawsuit in which male guards are not allowed in their housing units in toilet areas or shower areas and also have to announce their presence in there. And again, this doesn't really fall under like abolition. It doesn't make the prison system smaller or, you know, less there, but it does win a victory for women who have to live in those conditions and aren't going to get out tomorrow, you know, because we're not dismantling the system tomorrow. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
I think one of, Vivian talks about the criminal justice system being called the criminal justice system when in fact it's a justice system that is criminal, and I think there are moments where the system actually reveals a great deal about how it operates and what it is. And I think one of those things is when it talks about prisons serving the function of preserving the social order. Right? And so if that social order is one that is characterized by white supremacy, that is characterized by sexism, that prisons further support that social order. And in that context, I think it's very exciting to have Brendan here from the Anarchist Black Cross Federation that does a great deal of work that he'll talk about in much more detail and far better than I would, supporting political prisoners, which is another aspect of, I think, in the continuity between these three presentations of understanding prison's function in preserving the social order in the way it is today and in preventing any potential efforts to transform or change it. So, thanks for that.
Thank you. That was a very nice segue. I do want to point out, for my benefit more than yours, that I was listed on the website, probably on the program, Brendan Story is Speaking. That was a complete misunderstanding. I was never planning on speaking until this morning when I got a call that the person who was speaking, Michael, is sick with food poisoning and throwing up. So he would have been impeccably prepared. He would have knocked your socks off. I will shake your socks a little bit. So, I'm Brendan Story, New York Anarchist Black Cross Collective, and we're part of the Anarchist Black Cross Federation. And we do engage in prison work, but in this way that's very specialized, which is supporting political prisoners and prisoners of war. And in some ways, it's, as Danielle points out, it's very useful, my coming after these two women, because, and talking about the political nature of imprisonment, because the plight of political prisoners is absolutely tied up in those struggles and in that function and other ways that the prison system functions. It's also difficult. It requires a little code switching, because the more that you understand about oppression, about segregation and oppression and white supremacy in our society, the more you understand about the nature of prisons in your society, it becomes more and more difficult to understand what is a political prisoner and how are they difficult from other prisoners and how can we prioritize this group of prisoners while we continue to resist imprisonment in general and the state in general. So that is my challenge at this moment. So, as we're talking about today, imprisonment is inherently political, and besides teaching a type of segregation, but besides grounding the idea of safety in being segregated from other people, instead of having a reconciliation or instead of having, you know, truth and justice, you know, we also have basically a whole class of, or a subclass of people in America who are necessary to the functioning of our capitalist economy, being a reserve army of labor, being kept in poverty so our economy can function, which is an act of war in itself, right? As people who are made to go without, and then whose actions are especially policed and criminalized, they're essential for the system to function, but they're inconvenient. So they need to be put under lock and key, managed more closely, and the prison is one of those control mechanisms, and it's part of how the state functions, similar to the border. And that and all these other ways we're talking about is a way that prisons work, but they also work more directly in terms of counterinsurgency. And that's more, we can see that more, especially the more political, the more overt, confrontational and organized our resistance is, you know, the more that we see those kinds of dramatic reactions. But we can always see the prison working in terms of capturing people who are trying to make the world better, in a very deliberate way. So the people that are in prison for political reasons are people who have consciously, for the most part, have consciously been on the forefront of these kinds of struggles for liberation. So a political prisoner, I do not have the definitions in front of me, I'll tell you at the end where you can look it up, but basically, a political prisoner is someone who is imprisoned specifically for their political ideas or their political actions. And there is debate about what you call a political prisoner, and you recognize the political nature of all imprisonment, absolutely. But for the Anarchist Black Cross Federation, it's those people who prior to being incarcerated were active on some level in terms of social liberation struggle, and were imprisoned as a result of that. The other people being supported, which is a very similar concept, is a prisoner of war. And that means that in the same way that someone might be in a conflict, you know, between foreign armies, you know, say a U.S. soldier in Iraq could be imprisoned by Iraqis, that same dynamic applies to people within U.S. boundaries who are fighting for sovereignty, for liberation, who are taking up arms against a colonial power, a foreign power, or white supremacist power. So both resisting prisons, resisting the state, undoing incarceration, prisoners' rights, are important and necessary tasks, but prioritizing these people, these comrades, these fighters, is also a necessary task, whatever your area or your specialization of resistance. And to convey that idea, you can imagine that you are in a political group, that everyone in the group that you're in, maybe there's five people, everyone in the group you're in is doing similar things or doing different tasks as part of the same project, and say three or four of them go to jail as a result, doing the common things that you're doing, they're locked up. And you can think about if as your group, let's say your group believes in solidarity and taking care of each other, if you continue to do the kind of work you're doing and then do nothing for these people that were in your group, that was your comrades, that are taken away for doing the things that you're doing, it would make you look extremely hypocritical, you would lose credibility, and beyond how you look to anyone else, things would stop to make sense to you anymore. You would stop to have hope of how can you accomplish anything when you're so helpless to being attacked? How can you take another risk for this group? How can you continue being in this group when you know You can go in and nobody does anything for you. Nobody sees a value of having you out alongside them to continue what you're doing. Everything falls apart. And I hope I'm not being insulting to people who have actually been in this situation, because odds are that there are people in this room who have. But what I want to point out is that is a situation. Any of us who believe in things, these like liberatory ideas, ideas like anarchism, ideas like resistance, that is a situation that we find ourselves in that moment. The fact that this group that we're in is a much broader group, that it has to encompass a variety of different movements, a variety of different generations, a variety of different ideologies, it's not really an excuse not to do this work. And worse, it's not an excuse to not take advantage of the opportunities that it offers, which are immense and really have to do with rebuilding the whole idea of being a resistance movement, of movements, of having solidarity with each other, of taking care of each other. So our political prisoners come from a variety of groups and generations, most of them from the older generation that were most active in the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s. However, we're getting more and more political prisoners now, by the year. So they come from things like the Black Liberation Movement or New African Liberation Movement, coming out of the legacy of the Black Panther Party, coming out of the legacy of the Black Liberation Army. Also, white anti-imperialist groups that, like the Weather Underground or the United Freedom Front, who are struggling against imperialism and white supremacy on a global level as well as on a local level in solidarity with comrades of color. We also have the American Indian Movement and other indigenous sovereignty and national struggles. We have the movement for the independence and sovereignty liberation of Puerto Rico. We have a few from Chicano liberation struggles. And now we have Earth Liberation Front prisoners, Animal Liberation Front, and other radical environmentalists, other radicals concerned with the rights and the liberation of animals. Now we have people facing political charges for being in other types of above ground organizing, like coordinating the Republic resistance against the Republican National Convention. In the 60s and 70s, you can see political imprisonment very clearly. You can see the state attacking these movements, using COINTELPRO, using the FBI, using everything in their arsenal, including imprisonment, to try to break resistance, dismantle it at its roots when it was presenting a threat to the entire system, including the prison system. And there was huge links between all of these movements and resistance against prisons and within prisons. But now we see another sort of phase where there's something like a consolidating of power going on in the ruling class, where, you know, they've been trying to consolidate their gains in terms of global capitalism, global white supremacy, and globalization. They're also in a place where the resistance movements are not making a lot of CEOs crap their pants. A few, you know, but not a whole lot of CEOs are crapping their pants. But at the same time, they see an opportunity that these fighters, these political movements, have left an impression on people's imaginations, that while they've been eradicated from certain, all but eradicated from neighborhoods where they used to be very important, from whole areas, from people's minds, from people's ways of thinking, you know, everything is on the internet, a lot of things are in college libraries, a lot of things are in people's heads walking around, people talking. And it's very easy to imagine this next generation coming up to look some things up, to get some ideas in their heads, ideas that are just as relevant as it's ever been in terms of liberating our world. And so the powers can see that, and they would like to change the end of the story. And the end of the story they would like to see is that everyone who's ever stood up believing in anything, that can imagine thinking outside of the box, that can imagine a little more than holding signs and picketing and making phone calls, and no disrespect to any of that, because I'm doing it and we need it, but that anyone who does more than that, who thinks outside of the box, who becomes a real fighter, that everyone like that gets locked up forever. Everyone likes that, like that gets locked up, they die. They die in prison, they get sick in prison. That people who did things years and years ago and got away with it could still be hunted down 30 years later. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to rewrite history right now. And so the future of resistance depends a lot on political prisoner support. And none of that was in my notes, so I'm going to look at them now. So, I mean, the fact that the movements that are in prison are very disparate, are different generations, are different cultures, it provides an opportunity for people across these divides to learn from each other. So what that means, if you are an older person from an older movement in prison, then connecting with, say, a younger activist gives you a chance to find hope in the new kinds of things that are being done that you might not know about. It gives you hope in maybe in a small way being part of those struggles and lending your ideas, lending your advice to them. And for your campaign to free yourself out of prison, you have access to new technology, you have access to new ways of thinking. So that generation can divide can be very useful for the older generation. It also is incredibly useful for the younger generation. If you're walking around as a younger anarchist, younger activist, it's not always easy to meet older people who have been making conscious, deliberate, huge sacrifices and huge commitments to the struggle and have been weathering it and have been making those choices and doing what they need to do for decades. Talking to one place you can always find those people is in prison, unfortunately, until we change that. So prisoner support corresponding with the political prisoner and prisoner of war gives you an opportunity to connect with that older generation and learn things that can be very useful. And it gives us an opportunity to try not to repeat all of the mistakes that they made also, because they did make some mistakes. Also, if you're a person concerned about the environment, you have that opportunity to connect with environmental prisoners, Earth Liberation prisoners. You also have that opportunity, to connect with serious class struggle prisoners and anti-imperialist prisoners. Whenever you're crossing a movement, these are prisoner support, though it comes out of this horrible situation, it gives us a great opportunity to reconnect these movements, to reconnect our thinking, and to go forward in a more unified way. So the political prisoners and prisoners of war, they do need people specializing in political prisoner support. I'm not going to lie. We need lots and lots of more people doing this. We need more anarchist Black Cross collectives. And you don't have to be part of anything already. You don't need to know anybody to get started doing this. But what's more important than doing political prisoner work as what you do, that's what we need because of this great shortage in this work. Now, but it's not that there are huge limitations to what we can do, and I think this goes for almost anything, like specializing in a certain discipline. Like what we need a lot more than that is for all of the other kinds of liberation movements, all the other kinds of campaigns, the things that people are thinking of, to address political prisoner support in a small way and to integrate that into all of the work that they're doing. That's what's most important to me, is that whatever kind of activist you are, whatever kinds of things you're thinking about, that you take that opportunity to reach out to the people who are in prison for believing in the things you believe, or doing the types of things that are done out of these beliefs, out of a complete commitment to these beliefs. The people that are captured as a result of that, that they're not left behind, that we take them forward in our work. So that means that, that all kinds of radical groups can have free all political prisoners and prisoners of war as part of their mission statement, as part of what they're putting out to the world. It means that people in all kinds of movements can be writing to political prisoners, both as a correspondence, making friends, as being part of their support, and to get their ideas, to give those prisoners some type of a voice when that connection is possible, when that friendship works out. So, yeah, I was going to say something about, I have an idea there about prison abolition, but I can't untangle it. So I just wanted to drop a few things, a few intersections of anti-prison work and activist work and political prisoner support. There is a black liberation prisoner who is an anarchist, Ojuri Lutalo, who is locked up very nearby in Trenton in a maximum control unit, or MCU. And he's had the opportunity to make some contributions towards the campaign to shut down these maximum control units, which, and it's an interesting intersection of how prisons work and political prisoners, because the idea for the maximum control unit arguably started, was first tested out on prisoners of war within the U.S., that one of the first sort of prototypes of a maximum control unit was in Marion, Illinois, where they put New African prisoner of war, Sundiata Okola. And so they needed it immediately. They needed a way to put someone under complete control, to put him in a small cage and keep him under something like 23-hour lockdown and use experimental ways of controlling a human body. And so that was done to Sundiata Okola. He's a survivor of that. He's now in a medium security prison, also in New York State, in Otisville. Ojuri Lutalo is now in the institution that came out of that idea, the maximum control unit, and that also gave rise to the supermaxes. And so they've tested things out on our freedom fighters that they then use as ideas of how to control people in general within the prison system. So you get involved with opposing maximum control units. There's a campaign called Stop Max. It might be stopmax.org. I'm not sure, but you could Google Stop Max to get involved with that. Also in Marion, Illinois, we have there in Terre Haute a new kind of facility. And that kind of experimenting is happening now. It's called a Communication Management Unit, CMU. And right now we have two political prisoners in Communication Management Unit. My friend Daniel McGowan is in Marion, Illinois. And Tsunomo Shirasaki Daniel McGowan is technically an Earth Liberation prisoner, but I knew him as someone who supports political prisoners and as someone organizing against military counter-recruitment. But, you know, one day I got an email that he had court, and it turned out he was being indicted for his participation in two arsons in the Pacific Northwest around Earth Liberation. But he's still my good friend, and we're just separated by some communication management right now. So he's there. Shirasaki is a Japanese national, but he was part of the Japanese student movement. He also fought in Libya on behalf of Palestinian liberation. But he was imprisoned and extradited to the U.S. because he's accused of an action against a U.S. embassy. So he's one of the few. He and Daniel are both among a minority of non-Muslims in these facilities. The Communication Management Unit was first called a counterterrorism unit, and they, like, I'm told there are places where the name has been scratched out or plastered over. And they're specializing in managing communication. They haven't gone through the kind of paperwork and channels that you normally would go through to set up a new kind of facility within our prison system. So very little is known about these units. They're, for the most part, you know, they're imprisoning people with terrorist enhancement charges, as Daniel, out of a free speech issue, has a terrorist enhancement charge because something that's in a communique, which he didn't write. So people that they want to brand as terrorists or consider as terrorists with their special funding that to use to combat terrorism, they're creating these special facilities that specialize in monitoring people's communication out of prison and in coming to the prison. And they have very, very limited telephone. Their visits are 4 hours a month and through glass. It's not a nice place at all. So you can learn more about the communication management through a link on or a page on Daniel's site, which is supportdaniel.org. And it might be like supportdaniel/CMU or something like that. Another thing going on is that about prisons in somewhat collaboration with political prisoners and Daniel McGowan recently wrote a dispatch about it. There's a bill in Congress called the Good Time Bill that right now, thanks to the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, federal prisoners have very little possibilities of early release. They can get a very small percentage of their time off. And this bill would expand that substantially so that the time every day that you're in prison that you don't break the rules, you're earning a little bit of time towards some early release. This might be attractive to the government right now. And I hate saying this, you know, I was in the IWW and the ruling class and the employing class have nothing in common. But this might be attractive to them right now because they want to save money. And it costs them a lot to keep expanding the overcrowding federal system with no end in sight. And so this could give the federal government an opportunity to release these prisoners early and save themselves a ton of money during their financial crisis and under the leadership of their so-called progressive president. So this would affect some political prisoners. Daniel McGowan and virtually all of the Earth Liberation, Animal Liberation prisoners, the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty prisoners, most everybody that was part of the Green Scare, which was this last wave of oppression against environmental and animal prisoners. It could affect Oso Blanco or Byron Chubbuck, who is a Chicano fighter who would expropriate money from banks to fund resistance in Chiapas. It could potentially help Helen Woodson, who is an anti-war activist. Possibly, though, I'm not sure how it would work with the international thing with the Cuban Five, who are international political prisoners who were convicted for their role as in espionage on behalf of, or their supposed role of espionage on behalf of Cuba. So, and to plug into the Good Time Bill, it is goodtimebill.info. So the other thing, of course, that the political prisoners and prisoner of war are involved in is struggles as anarchists, as socialists, as Black liberation, American Indian liberation, the liberation of Puerto Rico, all the struggles that are involved in. Also just their own liberation, the struggle to get themselves home, back into their communities where they can be more useful to people and more useful to each other. So to learn more about political prisoners and prisoners of war, you can go to abcf.net. That stands for Anarchist Black Cross Federation. We have a list of all the political, or of some of the political prisoners. You can click on their names for biographical information. There's also the JerichoMovement.com. And Anarchist Black Cross locally has an open program every alternating Tuesday nights at the 123 Community Space. You can go to 123communityspace.org. You can look us up on MySpace. But every other Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, we will cook dinner. We'll serve dinner. You get to eat. You hear a presentation about political prisoners and prisoners of war. You get to learn how to write a letter for the first time. We give you all the materials you need. You just have to show up, eat some food, listen, and you can write a letter to a political prisoner and prisoner of war, which is very... It's a very nice way to get started. This Tuesday we'll be focusing on the Puerto Rican prisoners of war and political prisoners as part of the Freedom Month put on by Pro Libertad, which is one of the organizations that supports the Puerto Rican prisoners of war and political prisoners. And I've probably talked too long. So.
open up for questions. I wonder if before we do that, if we could just do a quick go round and if people could just say their first names so we can say, oh, I liked what that person said and that kind of thing. Or I thought what that person said was bullshit and I have to point at them. So I'm Danielle.
Ashanti.
Amanda.
Paolo.
Lindsay.
Lee.
Jordan.
Juliana.
Dave.
Ruben.
Tessa.
Karen.
Jess.
And I have some questions of my own, but would like to open up first to any questions from you all. And I'll chime in if it's my turn. If you have some questions, you can, and you can direct it at one of the panelists, you can direct it at all of them.
I wanted to respond to some of what Vicky was talking about with the health, the fight for better health care inside prisons. And Vicky talked about this from a historical perspective at the beginning of ACE, the AIDS Counseling and Education Program inside Bedford, but I just wanted everybody to know that this is still a fight that's totally going on inside New York State prisons as well as prisons throughout the rest of the country. It's got two fronts or more right now. Like, people are doing what I guess is like grassroots organizing inside the prisons to create support networks like ACE. ACE has gotten the like legitimacy within the institution to have things in Bedford and in Albion and Taconic, like an office, and do peer counseling for prisoners who have HIV or AIDS inside. But it was this total fight to get that together and to keep it together, because grassroots organizing inside prison is so hard. It's hard to get resources like paper and contacts from the outside. If you're bringing in a peer educator from the outside, their clearance can be lost. So they've got all these difficulties on the inside doing healthcare peer counseling, even though that's the most sort of valuable, I think, counseling you can get around healthcare issues inside, because the healthcare providers hired by the prisons don't have people's best interest in mind. But on the outside, there's a movement to improve healthcare as it exists in correctional facilities, as well as the larger project of abolishing prisons. And this also needs not just support from people on the outside, but better publicity. People don't know how awful healthcare in prisons still is. HIV care and hepatitis care, especially, are a focus right now. I work with a group called the Correctional Association of New York, and they're a group trying to see that the Department of Health can oversee HIV and hepatitis care inside New York State prisons. Currently, the New York State Department of Corrections doesn't have anybody monitoring the health conditions inside their facilities, which is obscene, right? Because the DOH, the Department of Health, they oversee the health care taking place in nursing homes, psychiatric facilities, hospitals, yada yada. Right now, DOCS is providing the health care inside DOCS, and the only person watching or writing reports is DOCS. And those reports aren't even always available. So right now, there's a bill that we're trying to push through the New York State Legislature. Finally got a senator to put it forward with the new Democrats in the Senate. And they're going to try and get DOCS to oversee, the Department of Health to oversee care for HIV and hepatitis C positive prisoners at first. And then hopefully all health care inside DOCS facilities. So that's a fight that's still going on. So if you're not the type of person to want to go to, you know, Albany and push for this sort of thing, you don't have to. What we need also is people to publicize the state of healthcare inside correctional facilities. So if you're interested in that, Vicky or I can hook you up with more information. So.
Thank you. And we'll continue to open it up for questions to the panelists. And I also invite all of you, if you have questions for one another, to feel really, really free to pose those.
I have a question for Brendan. The communication thing that you were talking about with the prisons, is that stopping you from actually writing, Dan? Or
no.
You're still allowed to write them, but...
Yeah. No, I can write. And it's funny, he actually got a small list of people he could put on email, which kind of blew my mind. But they're doing that because email is even easier for them to monitor than going through these letters. But what they do look at is the content of the letters, and a little they do that for all prisoners, and particularly for political prisoners. But they do it more, and it does. I mean, I used to get phone calls, and now his wife gets phone calls. but that's okay. But I don't, you know, it has affected my communication. And it means I couldn't go and hang out with them all day in a visiting room. I could see them for hours.
It's so funny.
I wanted to piggyback on that thing about email, is that the federal system is setting up email for prisoners, but they either, it's easier for them to monitor it. I've had women, when I was working on my research on women prisoners' resistance, email me, private email me information, and there was something that one woman wanted to email me about Unicor, which is the Federal Prison Industries program in the federal prison she was in, and none of her emails ever got to me, and then she was finally given a warning, you cannot send emails about Unicor. Then her email access was taken away. She was threatened with going to segregation. To this day, I don't know what she was trying to tell me, because basically it had the effect of climbing her up when she realized how onto it they were. And with email, it's easy to like program something where you're like, if these words show up, it gets flagged, whereas guards and mailroom staff don't necessarily want to read tons and tons and tons of paper, you know, that's coming in. So one thing that people have found useful is that, like, if you're sending in a 10-page letter and the first 3 pages are about how your day went and you walked to the store and you did this, they get bored and they're not looking, unless they're targeting the prisoner, for what the hell happened on page 5. You know, but with email, you eliminate all that because there's that little sensor that says, like, Unicor is in there, flag it. You know, like, sexual assault, you know, is in there, flag it. So it's something that, while it sometimes makes communication easier if you're not trying to get these things out, like if you're just basically trying to communicate with like your mother, you know, like, and it's an easier way for prisoners, although they do get charged by the minute, you know, they get charged to prints, you know, at the same time it's another way for them to be able to surveil what you're doing and like what kind of ideas are going back and forth.
And then I think it is true, it's worth keeping in mind that whatever you write to a prisoner ends, to someone who is incarcerated, ends up in their record, especially if it is, you know, potentially inflammatory in any way. It also helps, the same thing of putting things on page 5, it helps to not use capital letter acronyms because those stand out really easily if you're skimming. So it's better to just kind of write it all out in lowercase letters because it's more likely to kind of just blend in. But to really exercise care because they're in a position, you know, they can't make a decision with you about what you can and can't say to them. And it is potentially even more dangerous to them than the conditions of their daily lives already. Are there other questions for folks on the panel?
I have a question. I've been writing to someone in a prison in South Carolina, and he recently told me that they're cutting food rations pretty drastically, and I wondered what I might be able to do about that. He said they're down to 2 meals a day and half rations. So I'm concerned about that.
And it's not something you can do. It's happening a lot. And I think it's a really, I think issues of food and nutrition in prison are already, I mean, the correct, like the Department of Corrections in the state, their daily budget for each person is 18 cents to give you a sense of what you're getting if you're inside. But I think particularly as food prices skyrocket and as we have fewer and fewer resources and not enough food to feed people on the outside, I think it's going to end up being a very, very important area for our work. But
do you all know of work going on?
Not in South Carolina. I mean, the things I was going to throw at is, like, are there other, you know, people in prison who have people on the outside that are, you know, incensed about this and willing to sort of, like, start organizing around this, like, either, like, you know, like, through media or through, like, pressuring, you know, whoever it is in South Carolina. Like, I don't know anything about South Carolina. But, you know, like, so it's not, like, on you in New York to try to do something by yourself, but to do something in coalition with other people who are concerned about this kind of thing. You know, whether it be family members and friends of other people who are being affected by this, or people, you know, who are doing, you know, like some sort of like organizing around prison issues in South Carolina. I don't, you know, off the top of my head.
It's not just a South Carolina problem either. It's a national problem.
But it seems that, like, it's something that, like, you know, like, you need to have more people involved with and also to know about, you know, because, you know, most people don't know about that. You know, like, I know that when, like, you know, like, when I was in high school and my friends went to prison, my friends on the outside sometimes were like, well, why should we bother? They got 3 hots and a cot. I'm still out here hustling, you know, and there's, like, you know, like, that sense that, like, you go to prison and you're taken care of, You know, like, especially if you're not looking at prisons as a form of social control, you're just like, well, I can be out here hustling and I don't know where my next meal is, or I can be in prison and look, you know, I got some food. You know, like, I don't have to worry about, like, a, you know, like, shelter over my head and all that. So, like, there is that sense where, like, people don't really think about, like, well, gee, you know, like, they're cutting food and you get two meals a day, or, you know, or anything like that.
I just wanted to clarify that while this is probably something that's happening, you know, all over the country because of the state of economies and state budgets all over the country, that if that letter is coming from a state prison, then the route to addressing that institutional change will be within that state, within the South Carolina Department of Corrections and the state government, unfortunately.
Thank you for the question. Do you have a hand up too?
It seemed like, were you going to respond to that?
I'll just respond quick. I mean, a lot of the food in prison is not just scarce, but so bad in a lot of places that prisoners who have someone on the outside to help put money in their commissary or can get one of the prison jobs that actually puts an amount of money on their commissary, a lot of them end up supplementing the bad prison food with, like, the bad commissary food. And this has become this, like, institutionalized bullshit where a lot of people depend on that, even though they shouldn't have to, because it's, like, overpriced bad other food. And so you end up with this two-tier thing, even inside the, you know, these institutions, where people who have support from the outside get conditions that are a little bit better than those who end up isolated in prison because their family hasn't been able to stay helping them.
And this guy has no family support, and prison industry is now not happening because of what's going on economically. So there's no money coming in any way for people like him in his prison. So he's just eating whatever they feed him.
I guess, I mean, I first want to say thank you very much. Everything you've said has been really incredible so far. My question might be really kind of mundane compared to what's been said, but I'm just sort of wondering about people's perspectives on jury duty. And is there any point to resisting the idea of jury duty? Or I know people have tried to get out of it by expressing their beliefs and then get stuck in it. Or, I mean, is this a way? Do we need more anarchists or whatever words you want to say, you know, doing jury duty? Or, I mean, are we helping the state by doing this? Or I mean, really anyone's perspective. I'd really like to hear what people have to say about that idea.
Yeah. I got asked to do jury duty years ago, and I really regretted my decision, because the first question they asked me was whether I could be unbiased around Rockefeller drug laws. And I said no, but I was thinking to myself, the only people who would say yes to that either don't know what they are or have a, you know, a very different view of criminality than I do. So I wish that I had actually lied and sat on the jury rather than, I mean, I was just thinking of, like, everybody who actually does have some sort of notion or some sort of ethic around prisons, automatically, if they told the truth, got eliminated. And it's tempting to, because everyone's like, oh shit, okay, I can get out of work for 3 days, but you can't, the idea of putting your life on hold for possibly weeks or months is, but I just got called for jury duty for next week, and I'm hoping I can get on one.
I'll steal a moment as the moderator to answer it. There's a long tradition in history of what's called jury nullification, which means you legally can be on a jury and you can say that you believe that we cannot impose a sentence against this person because it is unethical, and that's something you're allowed to do as a juror. You're not allowed to try and get on a jury to do that. So you're not allowed to, like, try and get on the jury knowing that no matter what the case is, you're going to try and nullify. But if you're in that room, you can say, like, it's like you get to go above kind of what's on the books, and you can say, I believe this law on the books is so unethical that we cannot in good conscience impose it, and you can refuse to convict someone on those grounds. it's legal to do. And if you Google jury nullification, there are more guidelines about how to do it. You cannot express your intention to do that going into it. And if they know, and if you're online being like, I'm going to nullify this jury, you know, then you can be in contempt of court because you're not supposed to do that in advance, right? But that is something you can do. And I believe very strongly it's one of the few places where one person can stand between someone and a prison system, or a prison sentence, rather. So thinking about that not only as a way of just, you have the option of just holding out and refusing to convict and having 11 people very angry with you for a few days, but you also have the option of nullifying once you're in there.
One thing I'd say, though, is for shorter sentences, if you get on a jury and most people aren't anarchists, on that jury, as just statistically speaking, they're not going to be, and they want to convict, and you don't, all you'll end up doing is hanging the jury. And for people who are serving shorter sentences, they can be tied up in the legal system for years, doing hung trial after hung trial, and if it's for things like potential terrorism, they won't send them home between trials, they'll stay in jail. So if someone was going to serve a year, they might end up spending 5 years in prison before the trial, just to see that they then get 6 months. And so it's not always best.
I guess I would really argue that point. I mean, I do think that, like, hung juries for sure can, you know, drag out the process, but I don't know, I was recently involved in a court solidarity case where as a result of a hung jury, like, somebody got to go home,
mm-hmm.
and, like, this was somebody from the RNC, and, like, he got to spend 2 months at home, and, like, now he's back in prison, and he's going to be in prison for a long time, but, like, talking to him, like, that made all the fucking difference
yeah.
in the process. So I guess I would just say, like, that's not necessarily something that I would apply as a blanket statement in terms of, like, what people want out of their experience in the legal system, because, like, there is a certain amount of agency that people have, whether to take a plea or go to trial or whatever it is, like, those options are there, and granted, they're only there for people who are privileged enough to access them, but, like, I don't know, I think the moral position of, like, being a juror or not is so difficult because, like, if you are opposed to incarceration, there's no way that you can talk to the person who's, like, being targeted by the state, but, like, and how to be in solidarity with that person if you can't communicate with them is, like, really an ethically complex issue, and so, like, I think drawing some sort of, like, hard line one way or the other, like, is, I don't know, seems questionable to me.
This is not so much the panel. I appreciate the panel as well. So it's more for us. We done heard about white supremacy connected to the prison industrial complex. We done heard about the horrible things going on in the women's prison and in the political prison. And the most that we can get out of this is health issues, food, and maybe manipulating the jury system. We don't get no more out of this than that. I mean, y'all got to challenge yourself on this. This don't make me feel good. It really don't.
And one of the questions I would also, so Vivian started us off talking about white supremacy. A lot of us in this room appear to be white, myself included. And one of the questions, I mean, one of the things that you suggested is that one of the things we have to do in order to end prisons is to end white supremacy, which I believe to be true. And I wonder what you think as white people we can contribute to doing that, if anything.
Well, I think we should start with this room and acknowledge the fact that there are two women of color on this panel. Yet you took up all the space as a white man. And that was kind of fucked up. And that after that, the majority in the room that we're talking were white people. And so these personal dynamics that occur do guide how these movements work and how we work together as a community. And for people not to see how the only time that Vicky spoke was when she interjected to get her voice in, and you spoke up to follow up on her. So I felt like you were on some level supplementing what she was saying, and you took up all of the space, and it just started to feel really, I didn't want to be here at some point. And it's a risk that we take, especially as women of color, coming into these spaces, when you're not conscious of how quickly you can silence us, we stop engaging, and we fall into our segregated, isolating
worlds. And as people who come from historically oppressed and colonized communities, and as people who on this earth come from the continually impoverished and dying communities, you have to be conscious of these dynamics. And I wasn't going to take responsibility to fix it in this room. I was very happy to just finish our time and go home, because I don't want to be here to school without the feeling that people are open to seeing even the most obvious things that we see every day. And the one woman of color in the back is nodding her head because she knows exactly what I'm talking about. And that is white supremacy. It's not just institutions, it's here.
Imperialists that are the most well-known political prisoners in the U.S., like, they, whether they were working on that or not, like, the current state of, like, the white anarchists, the white radicals in the U.S. is just, like, working on the internal oppression. And what was just said, like, a few moments ago was, like, there's more to it. Like, Marilyn Buck, who was a white woman, did more than that in trying to assist in liberating, like, Assad, or, like, in the aid of, like, liberating Assad Shakur, and, like, that, I mean, you know, that is a dynamic of, like, someone who obviously is clearly affected by patriarchy, but was white, and still, like, that, I feel like, is more solidarity than just, like, just discussing stuff, and just, like, I'm sure when we leave this room, majority of people are not going to take, I mean, like, much of this, like, white supremacy, like, thought beyond this room. But just in case, like, there are white imperialists that are still around and that, like, are in prison or are on the run or underground that did a lot more than any white anarchists have done today. And they might not have identified as anarchists, and they might still not, but they did a lot more than white radicals have done today.
As a follow-up to your, I guess, criticism of us, which is, I think, well-received, I think it's really nice to come in here and, with all due respect, talk about, like, jury systems and what we can do to make prisoners have more food and have more communication, but, like, they're still in jail, like, all the time. So what are we doing now to not just make it better for them while they're there, not to just make sure that they have HIV treatment, but to end imprisonment? Because I think that's, like, the ultimate goal. We're just talking about, like, while on the way, how can we make it more fluffy and comfortable? And I think we're kind of avoiding, like, what are you all doing, what are we all doing to end imprisonment right now?
I can speak to that. Do you want to? So people have talked about this word, prison abolition, right? And I'm part of a larger movement that's called the penal abolitionist movement. And the reason that people talk about penal abolition is that for generations we fought against specific institutions that have been replaced by new institutions. So when slavery was abolished, they made slavery legal through the prisons. And if you read the 13th Amendment, it says that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist except for punishment as a crime. And then you see this, like, mass incarceration building. And you also see the relationship between the economy and the prison over time. And so the reason that folks have been organizing around the penal abolitionist movement is that we're challenging not just the institution of imprisonment, but the entire penal system and its relationship to other social systems and political systems surrounding it. So there is on the ground work, which includes working in solidarity with prisoners. And that does include the stuff that Vicky and Brendan have talked about. And that stuff is key. It is part of abolishing prisons. Because you don't want to get caught up in a, you know, bird's eye view and ignore the suffering that's happening inside. So as you alleviate suffering inside, you are, on some level, challenging the inhumanity of the prison. Then you also have people who work on a policy level that will push for certain reforms that are considered to be abolitionist. Any kind of reform that minimizes the punishment, the scope of punishment of the prison, or the size of the prison, is an abolitionist reform, I guess, if that's a contradiction. So there's that on a very structural level. There's campaigns that people do, which I think are key, because for a long time I did that on-the-ground activist work, and at some point I felt like as activists we weren't thinking about where we were going. And so there's also like the larger educational campaign, because the power of the prison and the power of the law resides in people's belief in the law. When people stop believing in a specific law, that law no longer has power, and enforcing that law becomes almost impossible if the majority don't believe in that law. You know, so I think that that sort of ideological and on-the-ground relationship is really important. And as you build larger movements, you do it both on like the mental and spiritual, whatever, and then on the ground. So there is a lot happening. If you're interested in abolition, ICOPA, which is the International Conference on Penal Abolition, tours around the world, and every couple of years learns about the local organizing, wherever the conference may be that year. So there are spaces for it, but I think that the work comes in so many different shapes and forms.
I also really want to respond to your use of the words fluffy and nice, because I think having no health care and having very little food is a little more than just making it fluffy and nice. I know that you're aware of the suffering that people go through on a daily basis, but
I just feel like a lot of this talk is working towards a more functioning prison system where everyone has healthcare inside and everyone has ample food and communication, but it's still a prison system at the end of the day. It's really what
I think one of the things that you need to like think about is that like, you know, like we can talk about, you know, penal abolition and prison abolition, but like Vivian said, we don't want to do it from this bird's eye view. We're like, we're outside and we can kind of talk theory, but we also have to realize we're not getting rid of the system tomorrow, we're not getting rid of it next week, we're not getting rid of it next year. So how do we then make sure that all the people inside, this almost 3 million people, aren't, you know, like having their spirits broken, you know, like aren't just being warehoused and kept, and we're not doing these theoretical talks that, you know, go on without having any impact. You know, like in my work with women in prison and my work with folks through bars, it's like, how do we start like chipping away at this without making this system bigger? You know, and some of it is looking at some of these reforms that are going out and saying, wait a minute, this is bullshit. Like in California, the California Department of Corrections did a study and they found that 4,500 women incarcerated in the state of California didn't need to be there. They would be better off in the communities. Like, you know, like maybe like getting drug treatment or, you know, like alcohol treatment or mental health treatment. But instead of saying, let's think of a plan to start releasing these 4,500 women so they can be back with their families, back in their communities, you know, getting whatever, you know, whatever treatments or opportunities or resources they need to survive and thrive, instead of, you know, going back into these patterns that might lead to incarceration, they said, we're going to build these like female community rehabilitative centers. They're kind of like mini jails in these places where the women are originally from. But we're going to do this without closing any of these 4,500 beds in these, you know, gender unresponsive prisons that we currently have. And this was something that people advocated against, even though it would have been like nicer and fluffier in these mini prisons for these 4,500 women. The women inside organized against it. They signed petitions, you know, like they, you know, they spoke out about this. They said, you know what? We think this is bullshit. This is something that is basically meant to like have this surface reform where 4,500 of us get to go to these places that are closer to our family, you know, so they don't have to drive like 5 hours to like come and see us. And we have these gender humane and gender responsive programs, but basically this is expanding the prison system more. This is bullshit. And they organized against this inside, and people on the outside who are, you know, against this idea of prison expansion that saw for what it was. And also people who were against this because it impacted California's state budget. Not because they gave a fuck about prisoners, but because they said, you know what, why are we spending even more money for this? And it's kind of like, so it's working hand in hand so that way people on the inside are also empowered and to organize around these issues. And you can't be empowered if you're not getting medical treatment. You know, like if, you know, like if you're constantly being abused or harassed or assaulted. In the case of women in prison, since more than half of them have been physically and or sexually abused before coming to prison, that has a really big impact on self-esteem, ability to stand up for yourself, ability to organize. So when you have somebody who feels like they're constantly being sexually assaulted, their ability to stand up and organize is going to be a lot less, you know, than somebody who is not. You know, so you can't say that, like, well, we're going to do this prison abolition or penal abolition from top down, without also saying, like, well, what are we doing to, like, connect with people on the inside to be, like, what are your needs? You know, like, what are your needs? Like, how does this, like, you know, like, how does this work hand-in-hand with what we're doing on the outside so it's not just us deciding for them, you know, which is, like, maybe, like, another form of, like, you know, like, domination. here where, like, we on the outside will decide what is best for you on the inside. And we've decided that we're going to work for the next 10 years on prison abolition, but we're not going to communicate with you on the inside about what your needs are to make sure you can, like, if we magically abolish the prisons, you know, next week, you all can actually walk out, you know, and it's not that, like, some of you have, like, died from, like, lack of health care treatment or, you know, like, committed suicide because it's not mental health treatment or, you know, the list kind of goes on and on and on.
But also to bring it back to this concept of segregation, that we should not feel that we have to choose one or the other. There's a multitude of strategies that are available to us, and I think often in movements we start, you know, judging the ideologies and then judging the ideology will just, you know, the activists, and it becomes this as if we have to exist in isolation of each other, and it's part of that ongoing struggle to desegregate, not just our communities and our interactions, but in this, because I think this is a war.
Yeah.
Like, we are at war, we are under attack, people are dying, and they're dying multitudes of deaths, whether it's physical or different types of deaths that happen at this war. And so we need to be creative with our strategies and not fall into this, you know, top-down, boxed-up environment. But it's easier said than done.
Out of time, any of the folks up here on the panel want to make any closing comments? You're welcome to, but I know the next panel is starting to arrive.
One thing I wanted to piggyback on what Brendan said is, you know, like, keeping contact with people inside is really important. You know, like, political prisoners, for people, for social, you know, quote unquote social prisoners, and people not incarcerated for political crimes. One of the things that when I asked the women in prison that I work with, you know, what can people on the outside do to support you without inadvertently making this prison system bigger and stronger? Like, we don't support things like building mini prisons to put more people into. And they said, you know, one of the things that we really need is more contact with people on the outside. We need to know what's going on outside. A lot of us don't get news about this. We don't know that there's been, like, you know, like, people smashing banks in London, or even that there's, like, you know, like, conferences going on around prison abolition, penal abolition. You know, what kind of organizing work is being done? What kind of alternatives are people envisioning to deal with problems like violence against women in lieu of calling the police? Like, there's just, like, this, you know, there's the walls of prison, and then there's also the fact that there's, like, this wall of, you know, this wall where information isn't passing. And it's not helpful for us to have all this organizing work on the outside without getting that into people on the inside who are like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I, you know, it's like, this is something that we can start doing here and now and start talking about and thinking about, instead of, like, getting outside and being like, what's going on? So contact and support is also really important, whether it be for a political prisoner or a social prisoner.
Thank you, everyone.